Rescue me before I sink, lose the ship at sea.
Double Cross Radio. We are live from the state of Jefferson in the Pacific Northwest. Today is Thursday, September 27th, 2012, and this is our fourth show. I am Drew Lamb, and tonight I'm joined by my co-host, Real Life Patriots, Chuck Horton and David West, as well as our special guest, who we'll refer to as Colorblind Justice. Tonight, we will continue our discussion on free trade and the National Constitutional Sheriffs Association's event in Grants Pass. Now for some Fukushima news. TBS News on Japan TV reports Fukushima radioactive plume is circling the Earth every 40 days, fallout still showing spikes. Another article on Energy News, enenews.com, E-N-E-N-E-W-S.com if you want to look it up, reports of large amounts of iodine-131 being released from Fukushima reactors. And I talked about this a bit last week and probably the week before about how iodine-131 is taken up by your thyroid, and your body can't tell the difference between iodine-131 and potassium iodide, and it causes thyroid cancers. According to the National Cancer Institute, estimated new cases and deaths from thyroid cancer in the United States in 2012 is 56,460 and 1,780 deaths. Moving on to farming.
Drew, yes. I have a comment on that.
Sure.
Now, the iodine, the radioactive iodine, has a relatively short half-life. So anything that they measure has to be coming out in very recent past. I mean, it couldn't be, it wasn't from the original problem, because that's pretty much to non-detectable levels by now.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So this is, the fact that they can measure stuff means it's still being cooked and coming out.
Iodine-131 has a half-life of about 8 days, if I recall.
Yeah.
It burns
seven
off really
days.
Fast. Yeah. Yeah. And that is one of the most common contaminations. It gets picked up by cows when they're grazing, and it shows up in the milk. And when this incident happened, there were reports of iodine-131 in the milk in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not going to name brands, but I did detect milk that was clicking away at about 60 CPMs, if I recall, last spring, or the spring before last. And it was probably iodine-131, undoubtedly.
Yeah. And one other thing on this that people can do to protect themselves is your thyroid will not absorb the iodine-131 if it is full of iodine already. It will just leave it in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And your kidney will filter it out, and you will eliminate it with your urine. And so if you are healthy and you've protected, you've armed, pretty much put armor around your thyroid by making sure you have enough of that mineral, that'll help to protect yourself from being infected with the radioactive iodide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, potassium iodide helps block the uptake of iodine-131, and you can get that from tincture of iodine that you could paint onto your skin. You could get it from kelp supplements, but you want to make sure those are from a clean source. You don't want to consume kelp from the Pacific Ocean or from any source of water that might have been contaminated by any other meltdown or accident. Also, there's some foods that have lots of potassium iodide in them, and wine contains quite a bit of it too. So, you know, crack a bottle, have some wine, take your kelp supplements. Current Geiger count right now is 46 to 50 CPMs. I haven't seen any unusual spikes. I haven't been watching this really closely today, but I did sample some apples and pears that were picked up in Jacksonville over by where the Brit Festival is at. And I didn't pick up anything above background radiation on those. I think the highest count I got was about 38 CPMs. And my Geiger counter rarely falls below 30 CPMs anymore, but a little bit ago it did dip down to 16, so that's not bad. Sky's pretty clear today. It hasn't rained for a long time. I expect higher counts if and when it starts raining again. I'll check Radiation Network right now, see where the high counts are. San Francisco every week seems to have some of the highest counts in the United States, 46 CPMs. Looks like down there, Michigan. Looks like there's a count.
I would think San Francisco would cool off. Would have lower counts in September, October, and then it'd pick back up again once they start getting more of an onshore flow of air.
Here's a counter on the border of Minnesota and Wisconsin. 73 CPMs. Looks like there's a couple nuclear power plants over there. It looks like it's downwind of those. So somebody's releasing something in their steam, undoubtedly. Probably some tritium. Most of the reactors release tritium. Moving on to some farming news, GMO-free Jackson County is currently in an initiative petition campaign to ban the growing of GMO crops in Jackson County. In support of our campaign, nationally known expert on GMOs, Jeffrey Smith, is coming to the Rogue Valley on October 11th to lead a training strategy session in the morning and to give public lectures in the evening. And it goes on. You could get more information at GMOfreeJacksonCounty.org. Jeffrey Smith wrote a book called Seeds of Deception. It's an excellent book. I recommend that people check that out. And on that note, Chuck, I'm going to pass the mic on to you.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to hold it very long. I do have some economic and I guess we call it war news.
Doom and news.
We talked about the importance of free trade and how what we have isn't really free trade. I mean, if you had free trade, you obviously wouldn't need a treaty. So to call NAFTA a free trade agreement is just like a contradiction in terms, and it's ludicrous. So what's happening in trade is a lot of nations are devaluing their currency because the United States is devaluing their currency. And what happens when Ben Bernanke goes out there and says he's going to have unlimited quantitative easing and he's going to be creating $85 billion a month ad infinitum, these other countries realize that U.S. dollars are losing value, and so they're going to charge more for their products, and it's going to make the U.S. exports cheaper in their countries, and they don't want that. They don't want to be flooded by exports to the United States, so they're starting to debase their currencies, too, to keep it level with the U.S. dollar. They don't want to see that change. And so that's causing what they call currency wars, and the thing that follows after currency wars or trade wars. And I'm listening to the political candidates running for office. Both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are spouting what I say are the preliminary kinds of slogans that lead up to war. They're the kinds of things that people were talking about before World War II and World War I. And they're talking about currency devaluations. That was mostly Barack Obama. And Mitt Romney's talking about unfair trade policies and how China's, they're not using correct trade. Like we have the right to tell them how to run their country or something. So anyway, all this thing leads up to the fact they're using them as a scapegoat for the problems that are happening that the government has caused in this country. So divert people's attention away from it, and eventually they'll start banging those war drums. Well, they're also doing the same thing with Iran and their probably going to try and use Iran to do something to get China involved in a war so they can weaken them or somehow weaken their economy or something. I don't know exactly what their plan is. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist here on this. I just think that war is looking really probable now, and that's not going to be a good thing for anybody, because all war does is destroy wealth and kill people. And so I can't see anything positive to come out of that. Okay, now after all the bad news, which we just gave you, there was a pretty inspirational event this past weekend in Jackson County. And we had the Josephine County Sheriff brought together sheriffs from many counties in a region we'll call, it's pretty much the state of Jefferson with maybe a little bit of expansion in there, but it's the counties in rural southern Oregon and rural Northern California. And I don't mean Northern California, San Francisco. I mean on the border, Northern California. And they brought the sheriffs in those counties together to discuss some of the things that they're having to deal with. And our special guest was there recording this event. And so I'd like to ask him now. This is our colorblind justice is here, and he was there recording it, and have him give a kind of a report on it. And I've watched the recording that he made, and I'll chime in with some of the things that were interesting to me. So without any further hesitation, Mr. Justice.
Well, thanks, Chuck. Good evening, gentlemen, and good evening, world. I was just taking notes, and just hearing what was shared is not the kind of news that our parents would have ever heard. And so when we put that in context, we really have to recognize the truth of how different the world is today. And society operates by maxims, if you will, morality, maxims of morality and rules and such. So they're very different today. And so I'm challenged personally with having to say goodbye to my past and put on the hat of today in preparation for tomorrow. And I really appreciate this show because that's the theme that I'm hearing. And it really is what needs to be discussed for such a time as this. Well, with regards to the event, I was one of the videographers. There were several others, and I try to do the best I can with what I can grab. This was last Saturday in Grants Pass, and I try to cover both counties, Jackson and Josephine. And in my experience, Josephine, I'll kind of share a little bit about my opinionated bias, if you will. As close as these two counties are in proximity, okay, they're adjacent to each other. They are about as different as night is from day. Okay, which is, for me, it makes it worth the trip. You know, and I'm sure my brothers here in Jackson County can relate. and it relates to the sheriffs in each of the counties. You know, an elected sheriff, it is an elected office. He's in a prominent position, so he's under the scrutiny of the public every day. Well, it is very difficult to not compare county sheriffs in that prominent position. And I've observed Sheriff Gil Gilbertson since he ran for election. What was it? Boy, it must have been 2 years ago. And I was friends with Loma Warden from Roseburg, and she brought along her brother, Dennis. And I recall how she dressed him down. Okay. I thought, there's no way Loma's going to ever like this guy. Okay. And I was shooting my video about 10 feet away from Loma and her booth. She and Ray Kopitka operate NCSA, the National Constitutional Sheriff's Association. The website is NCSA 1.org, and I'll phonetically spell that: November Charlie Sierra Alpha 1.org. And that website is a very powerful primer, if you will, on the importance of the position of county sheriff. I think it's important to mention the trailblazer, as it were, retired Sheriff Richard Mack, whom I also video recorded, also in Grants Pass. He was in North Valley High, and this was about 2.5 years ago. And that was a spectacular event. He arrived. He first thing he did was apologize for having a cold, and he had a tough time getting through the airports. But man, he sure delivered a constitutional sermon, okay, if you will. And he inspired the folks to activism. And when we're exposed to this much information, it can be overwhelming. And, and a lot of this news, when collected into one brain, let's face it, can be depressing, and one can become somewhat despondent, I should say, to some degree. But for me personally, and this, I'm taking a kind of a side road here, to share a little bit about myself, to get me through the days and the weeks, I remind myself, I form a sphere with my fingertips touching each other. And I say, you know what? Colorblind, this is your sphere of influence. Everything outside this sphere, you have absolutely no control over. Okay? And a lot of other people have different spheres of influence. So when you put these spheres together, you bet, change can happen, but just one guy cannot affect change. But if he's in harmony, okay, and that's what I love about social media. You can really get a pulse of what's going on, not only what's going on, but how people are responding to it. What do they think about it? What do they think is possible, as a remedy? So my modus operandi, if you will, is to capture as much as I can and keep it on my, my collection of videos, which happens to be on the U.S. Observer Vimeo channel right now. Kudos to U.S. Observer for doing what they do, and you can explore that on your own there. It's a fantastic newspaper that defends the unjustly accused. So last Saturday, the NCSA event was actually hosted by Support Rural America. And there are a couple of gals. Okay, I mentioned Loma and Ray. They're from Roseburg, couple gals from South Jefferson. Aaron from Redding and Liz from, I believe, Scott Valley in that area. Siskiyou County, okay. And obviously those ranchers are having one heck of a time defending their existence through water rights. Okay? Why do they have to ask permission for federal agents, from federal agents, for them to have their property have access to water? We're talking about livestock. Okay? So, most people understand the dynamics of that debate, and it can really wear someone down, and we're looking for, praying for a remedy to come forward. And it is. I think it is. I do have hope for the future. So I'll just pause here and ask if there are any questions, and I'll resume afterwards.
I think you're doing a great job. So that's exactly what I was hearing so far. And for those of you who may be listening to this that are outside of the region, Western United States, this area would basically be a desert if it weren't for the mountains that trap snow in the winter and allow us to dam up the streams and store some water that we could irrigate fields and grow crops and feed our livestock. They would nothing would grow below 3,000 feet. It would just be a desert.
And water rights seems to be one of the greatest conflicts in this region. And you know, and you look at how the farmers in the Klamath Falls area have been affected, and then we've had some recent water rights issues in the Medford Central Point area. That gentleman who was recently thrown in jail for collecting water on his own land, and then even my own family's had issues with this. We have a pasture that's got a low-level area where cattle grazes, and it gets muddy and marshy in there, and it's hard to bring in rigs. It's hard to keep the weeds down, and it's always muddy and swampy in there because there's a county irrigation ditch that leaks, and this area fills up with water from a leaky irrigation ditch. It's a TID line, and so my father-in-law got a permit from the county to start filling it in. And when they were doing that water line project up the highway, he told them they could bring the dirt out there. They're digging that big ditch, bringing water from Medford to Talent, and truck after truck came over there and dumped dirt in there. And this was all done with the county's knowledge. And the county would come in, they'd clean out the irrigation ditches in the area, and they'd dump the soil and debris in that low area, and they contributed to it. And then one day we got a cease and desist letter saying, hey, don't do anything over there. We're going to come check it out. And a guy came over from the Department of State Lands, and he walked the property with me, and he was going to declare roughly 4 acres or so a wetland. You're just going to say it was a wetland. And he was basing this upon water that he saw and types of plants and trees that were growing. And I pointed out to him that these wetland plants were growing in non-native soil that had been dumped there, and it was fill. And so, you know, he was reasonable. He agreed with me, but still there was a small section of the property, after all was said and done, that was declared a wetland, and we can't disturb the soil right there. And to prove that it wasn't a leaky irrigation ditch would cost a lot of money. But here they basically came in and claimed the land. You know, you can't do whatever you want on it. You can't build on it. You could graze on it, but it's not a good area to graze cattle. You can't drive on it. You can't farm anything on it. You know,
but you can still pay taxes on it.
You can pay taxes on it. So these are the types of encroachments that are common. Now this was our own state government coming in and doing this, these problems that the sheriffs are having are primarily with the federal government. And
right.
What I wanted to throw out to you guys is what do you think the biggest issue is in Jackson County? Between our county and the federal government over property rights or water rights or whatnot?
Well, I think the biggest issue we have is the fact that our sheriff didn't attend this conference. He was missing in action. And he does not represent us. I think he has other political ambitions, or I don't want to accuse him of something, but he's got some other agenda. He certainly doesn't take his oath to protect and serve the people of Jackson County seriously. I've seen many instances of that where he has taken the side of the state against the people who are just trying and basically denied their property rights through his actions.
Yeah, and that kind of gets back to this colorblind, my comment about the black and white comparison between the two counties. I mean, can you guys relate to that? I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You resonate with that because, as I say, you know, it's worth the trip, you know, just to get out of this county and witness what, I should say, how a county sheriff should operate.
I tease all my friends from Josephine County and say, if you guys don't want to support your sheriff over there, we'll take him. Because they have trouble with budgets on their, with their staff. So
yeah, they have a lot of staffing problems. It seems to me that one of the greatest problems has been the impact upon the logging industry by federal government regulation and federal control over our public lands. Yes, and I was looking at a map recently that was showing land ownership in Oregon by the federal government. Almost all of the land, almost everything east of the Cascades is owned by the federal government.
Yeah, well, there's debate that the spotted owl was even native. Okay, mm-hmm. it was actually introduced as a non-indigenous species, where the environmental extremists would point to it and say, "We need to protect this species." Excuse me, you know, it wasn't even meant to be in this part of the world in the first place, and now they're so. It was certainly a Hegelian dialect, a type of an agenda, and I've heard the theory that the objective was to protect the earth, okay, which would be the minerals between the roots of the trees. So if the trees would stay, the soil beneath the trees would have to stay. And basically it's a lockout of minerals below the surface of the earth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it gets back to Agenda 21, the dam removals that have taken place in this area. They took out the Savage Rapids Dam. They took out the Gold Ray Dam, which is a huge strategic location for hydro. Mm-hmm. I video recorded that event as well. If anyone's interested, contact me.
During this conference, or the, I don't know what to call it, the sheriff's event or whatever this, whatever they call it.
The Support Rural America Constitutional Sheriff's Event hosted by Sheriff Gil Gilbertson.
Okay, during the event, one of the speakers, and I think it was the sheriff from Modoc County, made the point, and I had never thought of it this way before, and it was really, it's just one of those things that goes bing, and all of a sudden your worldview changes a little bit. He says, the federal government does not own that land. They control it. The land belongs to the people of the state of Oregon or this people of the state of California. The federal government just controls the use of it.
Right.
And they do not own the land. So that's – if they owned the land, they would be liable for property taxes, which they do not pay.
Yeah. Effectively, they're exempt. And I –
and that's because they don't own it. They only control it.
Sure. That's right. Hmm. Yeah, I had very in-depth conversation. It was a one-on-one with a gentleman who studies this stuff, and he knows the ORS, he knows the U.S. Constitution, and the conversation went to the public lands phrase, public lands, because before my conversation with the gentleman, I was under the understanding that public lands were strictly for the public, and I suggested that the government was trying to co-opt the language and claim that phrase, public lands, as government lands. Well, you know, public lands, public sector should own public lands. No. Public originally was the private makers. The public sector, the takers, are coming to co-opt the language of public lands. So, he actually backed me up one step, and he said public domain is the correct and proper phraseology to claim that property for the private sector, the makers. Public domain. Isn't that interesting? So there's a transition from public domain through public land to government land, and they are coming across public land, you know, with the Agenda 21 to, you know, abscond our property, which of course is the first plank of the Communist Manifesto. So.
Right. Yep.
Yes, and as they do not own the land, they just have assumed control of it. They still do not have the law enforcement authority. That is still in the hands of the county sheriff. And the places where they've been able to assert their authority are places where the county sheriff has been lacking in spine and has been he's consented to giving up his power or his rights, and all the citizens of that county then suffer. The guys that have shown some backbone and stood up to these guys they've won every court case. The federal agencies have backed down. The one guy, I think again this was the guy in Lodi County, he got the when they finally this he went after I think it was a Forest Service official.
Yeah, was that
the guy
sheriff
that got arrested for not having?
Yeah, the Wheeler County Sheriff, I think.
I think this was in California. I think it was okay. In Modoc County.
Oh, okay.
The guy was trying to make a living. He was up at a gravel pit, which he had a permit to go and get gravel.
Yep.
And the guy went up there to check him, and because he did not have his permit with him, he arrested him and put him in jail for 4 days. Now, the law doesn't require him to keep his permit with him, but the guy decided to arrest him anyway. And the video camera evidence, David, you'll appreciate this. The video camera evidence showed that the guy didn't even go and look in the back of the truck to see if there was gravel in it. He just went and talked to the guy, hauled him out and arrested him. And anyway, the judge was so upset by how poorly this guy had operated that they stripped him of his law enforcement powers. And this guy had given this person a ticket for not cutting firewood properly. And he even rescinded that, and that decision, which had happened months before, and basically just told this guy, just go somewhere and warm a desk. We don't want you out in the field. You're doing a lot of damage. And the judge was really upset about the whole situation. He said, you know, what's happening? So there are things that you can be encouraged about, but if you happen to live in Jackson County, you may never be able to witness anything like that happening in your home county.
Well, and this guy was clearly on a power trip. He could have followed the guy down to his house. He lived about 4 miles away, and the guy could have shown him his permit to remove the gravel. And instead, he detains him, drove him around Northern California for a while, and basically kept him detained for 4 days. It's completely outrageous. You know, it didn't need to go that far.
It was kidnapping.
Yeah, it didn't need to go that far at all. And what was that Mike Poindexter? Was that Modoc County where that incident took place? I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly either. I just remember the story, and I thought, wow, that is this is stuff that, you know, it kind of shook me awake in a way that I hadn't been awakened before.
Well, what got me was the sheriff that was talking about how he kicked those guys out of his county, kicked them out. So, you know, get the hell out of here. You don't have any enforcement powers here. Leave.
Yeah.
And
they brought him an edict or something from their bosses, and they put it on his desk. He says, well, fellas, you made one mistake. You didn't bring enough help.
Yep.
Get out of here.
Get out of here. Exactly.
Hey, yeah. would it be helpful to share the video with the audience who's listening in right now? I can just share that. Okay.
If we pull that off, that'd be cool.
Right. And if folks want to type this in, it's at vimeo.com/5001-2579. Again, the number after vimeo.com/5001-2579. And there's some jump ahead or skip ahead links there. If you hit the pause and then play so that it buffers beyond those points, you can click on those times to get to each of the sheriffs, and you can see who was actually there. I'll just go through real quickly. Obviously, Gil Gilbertson, Josephine County, John Lopey from Siskiyou County, all these guys had their hands full. Bob Hudspeth from Wheeler County, Oregon. Love to have him join Glenn Palmer from Grant County. So we now have three counties in Oregon having constitutional sheriffs. And then Bruce Haney from Trinity County, which is adjacent to Siskiyou County. And then continuing west to Del Norte County, Sheriff Dean Wilson. Love that guy. I mean, he comes at it from a textbook perspective. Okay. I mean, I picture him as kind of like a scout, explorer, master, you know, a leader of young men who have a heart for America. And he definitely gets the message out and inspires people to stick with it. And then, of course, Ray Kopicka and Loma Wharton did a bang-up job actually assisting, again, Liz and Aaron from South Jefferson. I need to put out a plug for Liz's website, pieinpolitics.com, pie, the letter N, politics.com. And then the overall website, and I'll stop there, is supportruralamerica.com. Supportruralamerica.com was the sponsor of this event at the Josephine County Fairgrounds. And boy, if we could just have an event like this in Jackson County, wow. Mm-hmm. You know? You know, we definitely have some light injected into the darkness, if you will. I do want to add a comment to water discussion. I've been in touch with retired Pastor Gary Harrington, he's the water guy. He got national attention along with his legal advisor, Dominic Nodder, who I met through a different path about a year ago. So, you know, Dominic and I hooked up, you know, with this Gary Harrington case, because there they were, the two of them, talking on Fox News. Okay, so it really comes down to who owns not just property, but who owns each of us? And does that question beg the answer of, well, are we property? Okay, so if you look at the cycle of water, okay, we all, you know, seen these illustrations of, okay, we've got the clouds, they precipitate, and the water accumulates into a creeks, into a river, into, you know, so on into the ocean, evaporation, boom, okay, round and round it goes. Well, guess what, guys? Our body is made of 70%, our bodies are 70% comprised of water, okay? So where, and the state wants to lay claim of ownership of the water.
Right.
Okay. Now, do they own the water in the clouds? Do they own the water on its way down? Do they own the water when it hits the ground? At what point do they begin ownership of this water in the water cycle? Mm-hmm. And Dominic, okay, I thought he made an excellent point. You know, the obvious thing is 70% of our bodies are made of water. Well, when rain lands on our skin, it actually permeates our skin. So if that rain that's owned by the state owns that water that just permeated our skin, well, that would be a takings by humanity against the state. Okay? And, I mean, legally, if they own that property, the water that permeated our skin, we would be, you know, we would we would be the defendant in a lawsuit having to defend the takings of the state's property. Now, how ridiculous is that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I mean, they just take it to the nth degree like that, and it just has to stop. It really does. But I'm not sure exactly how it's going to end, but hopefully it'll be nonviolently, and hopefully the courts can keep up with the relevant cases that must be heard today to keep the peace. Okay. So many people have been harmed and financially injured, you know, and, you know, there are foreclosures that are taking place. Ranchers, I mean, they're being assessed fees for raising dust for plowing their crops. Okay. Now, really, I mean, how insane does Leviathan have to get before the people rise up. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I'm sure you guys have things to add into that.
Well, I found it startling to listen to a bunch of sheriffs talking along these lines. You know, and just you know, we read this information and we talk about it, but here, you know, and we're always talking about the police state, you know, and the problems with the police state. But here we have these county sheriffs up there talking about that very thing that we're concerned about, that we're troubled by, and they are too. And they're actually doing something about it. And those guys are our first line of defense. They've sworn to uphold the Constitution and to protect our rights.
I think I'd only disagree with you in saying they're the last line of defense. If they go, there's no more defense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, true.
Well, there was a banner up on the wall, and they talked about the five boxes, and I don't know if I can remember all of them, but there's the ballot box, what's that?
Well, you've got the soapbox.
The ballot box,
jury box, and then the ammo box. Please use in that order.
And then there's one. Yeah, there's one more after that. The pine box.
The pine box, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah, those are the boxes that are used in the defense of liberty. And I guess if you don't use them, you'll end up in the pine box. Well, we're all going to end up in the pine box at some point, so we have nothing to lose, right?
Well, that gets back to immediately what comes to mind is, or who comes to mind, is a gentleman up in Alaska, young man, sharp homeschool kid who, you know, I mean, he's barely a shaver. I mean, still got peach fuzz, but he actually was elected the leader of the Alaskan militia. Schaefer Cox did a presentation to the good folks in Montana, and I've got that video out there, and he tells it like it is. He says, you know, the first enemy that we have to address is tyranny. And anyone or any entity that comes to us and says, you know, you need to do this, and when we question the demand, we ask why, and the answer is because we said so, is tyranny. Mm-hmm. So that we have to be cognizant of that, and examples of that come at us every day to different degrees. So, but what he said was, he was challenged by somebody who said, you know, Schaefer, are you willing to die for liberty? You know, liberty or death? Are you really willing to die? And he rejected the premise of that question, and he actually said, you know what? I'm willing to defend liberty. Okay. And so, meaning that he was willing to defend it at all costs. Okay. So I actually took that posture and I coined or at least altered liberty or death slogan that we see so often to liberty or else. Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel a lot more comfortable saying, hey, you know, there are consequences to not allowing liberty.
Yeah.
So, you know, choose it, you know. and put the onus on them, you know, Mola Mabe, et cetera,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. It's a really good point. Some people are afraid to act, you know, or they feel that they're too small or it's impossible or pointless. You know, I've had people say to me, what do you think you're going to do, take on the entire U.S. Army? No, not by myself, and I'm going to use my mind, you know.
right.
You know, but it is worth resisting, and it is possible to win. Right now, we're talking about an intellectual revolution, you know, a revolution of ideas, you know, and the Constitution is key, and that's what these sheriffs are pointing out. you know, and they're trying to encourage people to get involved. And I think it was Ray Kapitka she said some of the most encouraging closing remarks, and it was telling that there weren't a lot of young people that were there. You know, I wasn't there; I was watching the video, but there weren't a lot of young people there, and that's disturbing, because they're the future, and so we need to encourage the youth to get involved, to read the Constitution, understand the laws, understand how laws are made.
And they need to really understand their history. They don't. And they think that the way things are, the way things always have been. And the reason why that audience is all older people is because the older people know that, hey, we're in trouble. This shouldn't be this way. The younger people, they don't know. It's they think that that's just how things are. They accept it. And so if they learn their history, then they'll learn that that isn't how things have always been. There is another way.
So Chuck, you were going to tell us a story about Shipka Pass.
Yeah, and this is history, and this isn't American history. So some of you, in fact, most of you probably haven't heard of this place. It's Shipka Pass. It's in Bulgaria, and in the late 19th century, Bulgaria had been under the rule of the Ottoman Empire for around 500 years at that time. And just for background information, the Ottomans were about as brutal a dictator, police state, whatever, that you can imagine. They just had no respect for anybody that wasn't an Ottoman. And they didn't respect their religion. They didn't respect their ability to have economic freedom. They didn't respect their freedom to travel. They didn't respect anything. And they were kind of corrupt people, and they would go into the Bulgarian villages and kidnap young girls for their harems and all sorts of things like that. There's just, if you want to read about how repulsive and horrible they were, there are many books about that. Trust me, though, they were just awful. Well, the Bulgarians finally had enough of it. They had, the prior year, they had tried to start an uprising and had been brutally put down. The Turks had gone into some of the villages and just massacred everybody. They burned everything to the ground, and people running out of the buildings, they just run them down with horses. If they were still alive, they'd torture them, or they cut off their heads, or they just murdered everybody they could, just to show them that you don't rise up against us. Well, the Bulgarians then figured out, we don't have anything to lose. They're going to kill us no matter what. We might as well die doing something. So in the next year, they started another uprising, and this time they got some help from the Russians, who had their eyes on the Straits of Bosphorus, I think it's called, that empties the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. And so they were kind of interested in the Ottoman Empire receding, because they had borders with them, and then the northern parts of the Ottoman Empire were kind of bumping up into the territory that was claimed by Russia. And sometimes there was a state border, you know, buffering between them, but they were interested. So they were coming in on their side. And for some reason, there was this mountain pass that everybody deemed to be pretty important, although hardly anybody ever used this mountain pass, because it was usually snowed in the winter, and it was only available to use as a shortcut for a couple months every summer. So it wasn't really that important. And the real important fighting was going to happen down on the plains below the mountain pass. But they decided, for some reason, both sides decided to fight a battle there. And the first battle, the Ottomans were in possession of that territory, and they were able to drive back the attackers, because having the high ground was really an advantage in that place. And if you look at a picture of it, you can kind of see why. After the forces withdrew to kind of come together again, the Ottomans decided that they were, these forces that withdrew were going to go down on the plane and try and circle around and trap them up there. So they withdrew too. They left it, they abandoned it. So they came back for a second assault on it and found nobody there. So they just took over. The Russians also knew that the main battle was probably going to be down on the plane. So they left a few of their trained soldiers there, and they took most of their army and went down on the plains. And there's basically some Bulgarians up there that knew nothing about fighting. They were farmers. Anyway, they sit here in Wikipedia, it says 7,500 defenders, but I've read as probably in Bulgarian things that I've translated, they claim it was only 3,000. So the number is probably somewhere between 3,000 and 7,500 people were left up on top of this mountain to defend it. And the Ottomans found out they were up there, and they said, well, we'll just go back and run them off of that. We don't want them up there. And so they amassed an army of, it says here in Wikipedia, 38,000, but I read in the Bulgarian texts it says 30,000. So somewhere between 30 and 38,000 to attack them. And they came to make an attack, and they attacked them the first day, and they were driven back. But and that was very encouraging for the people that were holding those spaces, except the fact that they had used all their ammunition during that time. So they no longer had any gunpowder. And all they had left were rocks and sticks and the bayonets on their rifles. And they're outnumbered about 10 to 1. And the Turks kept attacking and attacking and attacking, and they kept being driven back. And meanwhile, the Russians heard, they sent word to the Russians that there was a battle going on up there, so they sent reinforcements. And about the, I don't know how many days exactly it was went by, but eventually they arrived with the reinforcements, and they were able to drive the Ottoman forces back almost all the way to Turkey. In the end, they say the total casualties were on the side of the Bulgarians and Russians was 13,500 killed and wounded. And I think that was mostly wounded, although it could have been about half and half. And on the Ottoman side, the Ottoman army, they had 24,000 killed and wounded, and I think most of those were killed, and 36,000 were captured. So that was 60,000 of their army just disappeared in this battle. And it basically was the end of the Ottoman Empire. They withdrew out of Greece, and they went back into Turkey. And Ataturk was elected to be became the new ruler as the 20th century dawned, and he reformed all the things that were corrupt about the Ottoman Empire and brought Turkey up to a modern world and really changed the way Turkey operated. He did a great job. Anyway, this battle is just to show you that you never give up. No matter what, you never give up. You don't have anything really to lose. If you quit, they're gonna pound on you just as bad as they will if you stand in there and fight. They're not gonna give up and treat you nice just because you lay down your arms or you stop fighting them in court or whatever. If you have truth on your side, that's a huge reinforcement. It's a huge thing that they can't counter. You have the high ground when you have truth on your side, and you just have to keep on pounding and pounding and pounding and using that to gain your advantage. And this is just such an inspirational story. Every time I think about it, I almost tear up and my voice gets kind of, I had to say it to myself several times before we started talking so I wouldn't get real emotional about it, because to me it's just like, this is humanity, this is what it's about, and we're all human in this planet, and this is in everybody. It's not just us in America. Everybody has this, and it's there out there for us to use. There's a lot of your friends and neighbors probably aren't awake. They probably were really worried about that bad call in the NFL game, and they're talking about that all the time. They think that's a lot more important than ship could pass and everything else, but they're wrong. The things that are important this is a life and death thing we're talking about. If the government says they have control of the water, what are you going to do? You're going to beg them for water every day? Are you gonna stand in line to get your ration? Are you gonna worry about going out in the rain because you might absorb something and get arrested? Because it belongs, that's property of somebody else. And this, there's, you have to make your stand and you have to stand your ground. That's all there is to it. That's it. So I think that was, that story to me kind of is a lot of what these sheriffs are doing. There's only one sheriff in each one of these counties, and they're standing off hundreds of people that are out there trying to take away the rights of the people that that elected them. And they're standing their ground and they're beating them. And that's the same kind of inspirational thing that I think is went on in Shipka Pass.
It's a very inspirational story. Liberty or else.
Yeah, exactly. Chuck, I can't help but, this colorblind, I can't help but ask what year this was and if you've ever seen the movie 300.
1877.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the movie 300, and this is similar to it, only they won. It's similar to the Alamo, only they won. And actually, I think that they probably had more to fight for. It's, if you go and read all the abuses that they suffered under the Ottomans, you'll understand why they just said, this is it. I can't take this anymore. You know, generation after generation after generation, and just and anyway, David, this would be a great movie. Elijah, Mount Elijah, there in it's near the border of the Oregon Caves National Monument. It is almost exactly, looks almost exactly the same as Shipka Pass. It would be a great, you could be here in Southern Oregon.
Yeah, that would be quite the story. I'm reading the Wikipedia entry right now. Actually, it's pretty impressive.
And I'm not sure the Wikipedia one is the absolute correct one. I tend to think their numbers are probably really close. The things that I've read that I've translated from Bulgarian have different numbers, and so they may be. I think this is kind of compressing everything that took place there into one battle, and I was talking about just the one where the guys are up there with no ammunition, and they were winning. They were still killing
most of
this army.
I got to cut us off here. We got to wrap up the show. This is the fourth episode.
Still to rise.